I feel like this is an AA meeting. I am ADHD. have dealt with it throughout most of my life, at least as long as I've been aware. I was in parochial school 1 through 8, spent probably 90% of the time in the hallway, then transferred to public school. I was my high school's best truant. So that evolves into probably why I do the work I do. I didn't realize that I could overcome that and be successful until I was about 35 years of age. And that's when I finished undergraduate school and went on to law school, graduating with honors, going to night school because that's where I functioned best, learning how I learned, and then going on to do some really fun things. So I am able to communicate and identify with the students that I work with, both in a positive form in that I can say I've been in your shoes, I do understand some of the things you're experiencing, I can relate to some of the difficulties you are having, and on the other hand, I can also look them in the eye and say, don't give me any excuses, because we together can overcome this, we can put some things in place, but you've got to work with me. So that's my approach with most of the students that I work with. It's not, I will take care of you, I will hold your hand, I will get you through all this, and all those nasty people are going to go away. That's not realistic, and I'm not going to mislead a student into thinking that. The other thing is, I want you to keep this in mind throughout my talk, because I truly do believe in it. I was a mediator before I went to law school. I have trained mediators in several states, both for state mediation programs as well as hearing officers and judges who have acted as mediators. I came from out east, and out east mediation or neutral fact finding is a mandatory first step for in the complaint proceeding, and the only way to opt out is if you actually give an excuse or some rational reason for opting out. Although mediation is the voluntary process, the attempt to mediate must take place. As a hearing officer and an administrative law judge, we were also allowed to take a time out in formal proceedings and try to remedy the situation if both parties were in agreement. I was involved in probably close to 300 cases. 90% of those were resolved before they went to due process. So I do believe in this. 90% of the time it works. I always go in, even though I'm an advocate and people usually bring me on when things aren't going right, my first approach is always a collaborative approach. And I find a lot of times it's not that people don't want to do things. It's either that they don't know what to do or somebody's tying their hands from doing the right thing. I'm pretty good at gauging who's on my side at the table. They might not be able to come forward. They might not be able to talk about it. They might not be able to say anything outright, but I'm pretty good at gauging who's there that wants to do the right thing. And I will also align with them and empower them to do the right thing without throwing them under the bus. And we got a lot of people who are in the trenches who want to do the right thing. So again, this team approach, and the parent is an integral part of that team, is essential for, I did divorce mediation too, a lot of it, okay? This is very similar. In Michigan, these relationships have to go sometimes as many as 25 years. So if you destroy that relationship and these people still have to work together on behalf of a child, the only one that's going to suffer is that child. So I will go overboard with trying to maintain and remedy those relationships if necessary. Okay, so please keep this in mind. Even though I'm going to probably talk about some things that aren't going right, haven't gone right, probably some horror stories, keep that in mind as far as what the initial approach is. Sometimes you get down the road and it doesn't work out. Very few, but you may have to go another avenue. But for the most part, this is what works. Let me just gauge how many of you are challenged with ADD or ADHD. Okay. And how many of you have children who are challenged? Okay, most of you then. Early childhood children, elementary, quite a few. Okay. Middle school, high school. Wow, we got quite a variety here. Okay. As far as the approach, when you initially realize that there are problems, a lot of times you look back and say, oh, I should have known. Oh, boy, this was a red flag. And you start kicking yourself for not intervening quickly enough, strong enough, whatever. My advice to you is let it go. You can't change, and I tell this to parents all the time, you can't change what has taken place up to this point. A lot of times they want to go back and they want to hold them accountable. And yeah, you know, a due process allows for that up to 2 years. But going back, in my opinion, usually is not very productive. So my focus when I become involved in a case is usually going forward and starting from a point where we can improve things. Now, the information from going back is usually pretty critical. What hasn't gone right? What were the needs of the child that weren't met? What kind of a situation do we have now as a result of what went wrong? But we can't go back and just keep rehashing meeting after meeting about what didn't go right. So the focus needs to be forward focused. The focus also needs to be on the child, the student. Again, usually when I get involved, there's a lot of adult issues by that time. Fortunately, people are learning about bringing the advocate on board early. But my impression, and I've heard from a lot of people, is that until recently, there have not been a lot of advocacy resources in Michigan. I'm familiar with both coasts, and nobody goes into a meeting without an advocate. I mean, it's just, everybody expects it. School districts expect it. It's the way it is. But here, I've been doing this here now almost 5 years, and I had a lot of undoing to do when I first started doing advocacy, because there were some groups here that were very adversarial. The approach was to go in and lay blame, bulldozer, just mow people down. And that was what the school districts expected as soon as they heard the word advocate. That was a huge disadvantage to being able to sit down at the table and start talking about real issues. So now, again, you know, having worked in most of the school districts, at least most of the ISDs in southern Michigan, that has changed, and for the better, in that the school districts are not intimidated. They don't start putting up brick walls the minute they hear the word advocate. I have built some pretty good working relationships with school district attorneys, who people usually view as the enemy. They're doing their job. I've got school district attorneys who find out that I'm on a case, and they're on the phone. Hey, Deb, let's go out to lunch. What do we need to do here? I've got school district attorneys who say, I don't need to be at that table. I trust what you're going to do. Just give me a call if you need help. Okay, those kinds of relationships are invaluable on behalf of a child. And those are the kinds of things that I make a lot of effort in developing. So again, the team consists of everyone who is reasonable and looking out for the best interest of the student. You do have people at the table who aren't. I just circumvent them. That's not that hard to do, especially if you've got people there who really want to be empowered to do the right thing. So learn to become a team member. Focus on the student. Don't try to control the process. And I say this to school. I do these trainings for school districts, too. I say that to school districts as well as parents. Nobody needs to control the process. You need to let the process work for your student. And if everybody is on board, that will happen. One of the first things you do when there's a problem, and you even before you ask for an evaluation or start going down that road, get the kid's record. And in some districts, you want to get the kid's record right off before you start doing anything, because you want to make sure that nothing changes in that record. So the first thing you do is ask for the complete record. Now, in Michigan, there are two records. There's the general education record, CA60, And then there's a special education record. So when you ask for records, make sure you get both. Because special education record, if they're already in special education, is going to give you a limited view of all the communications, correspondence, and information that relates to a child. If you have not begun the process, you're only going to get the CA-60. And that's just going to be your typical report cards, progress reports, that type of thing. First thing you do when you think that your child should be eligible or needs special education services is send a written notice. Must be in writing. I have parents who call me up. I have asked for an evaluation every single year. Do you have it in writing? No. I just asked for it. I can't do a thing with that. Along the same lines, every communication that you have with the school district along these lines, along the avenue of making requests, getting services, should be in writing. Email is okay, but you want to create a record. You want to create a record, not that you're going to go to court or that you're going to need evidentiary documents or whatever. You want to create a record so that you have a baseline for progress, so that you have communications clear and concise, and nobody can say, that's not what I meant, that's not what I said, or I never said that at all. If it's not in writing, it either wasn't said or it wasn't said the way you thought it was. And I can't do anything with that. Okay? So telephone calls, hey, you know what? I am really busy right now. Can you send me an email? Or if you happen to get caught in the school corridor and somebody says, hey, I just need to talk things over with you for a minute, don't be rude and say, nope, can't talk right now. Have the discussion, but go home and write an email. Per our discussion today, this is what my understanding is. Please reply. Okay, because you don't want to just have a blanket email out there that says what you thought it said and then have no reply from the school district or an administrator. You need that reply to make sure that you're both on the same page. Okay? State and local eligibility for education services. The IDEA instructs under Child Find that the school district has a responsibility to identify children who are in need of services. Okay, so the school district should not just be relying on parents to make the request. Also, anyone can request an evaluation on behalf of a child. It does not have to be a parent. It can be a teacher, and I've had teachers make those requests, make those recommendations. It can be anyone who has knowledge about the student. I've had outside therapists make requests on behalf of students because the parents had their own challenges and were not able to do that. I get CMH all the time will make a request on behalf of a parent. So it does not have to be a parent. It does have to be in writing. And the school has to respond to that. And if they deny it, they have to make a written response that identifies why they're denying it, or if there was an evaluation that they're claiming was done, why that evaluation is sufficient to make a determination, usually of ineligibility, but it can also be eligibility. They'll usually say, oh, we already assessed, we already did that. Well, they have to validate that they already did it. They can't just blanketly deny. Okay, so then the process goes to allowing the school district to do their evaluation, which you must do first procedurally. If, after that evaluation, and listen to these words, okay? Actually, I'm going to... These are critical because you do not do an evaluation for a predetermined result, which is what many school districts will try. Oh, we're going to evaluate them for ADHD. We're going to evaluate them for ASD. We're going to evaluate them for a specific learning disability in math calculation. No, they're not. They're going to do a comprehensive, and this is under IDEA, multidisciplinary,
educational, and that is in the broadest sense, not just academic, evaluation. That includes all areas of suspected disability. And that can be extremely complex for some of our students, especially where you're looking at ADHD. ADHD can be a diagnosis in and of itself, but ADHD symptoms can be secondary to or related to a host of other disabilities. Now, you may not get eligibility under some of those other disabilities. For example, Asperger's has been removed from the DSM. So now the school districts are saying, oh, we no longer have to deal with Asperger's. It's gone. It doesn't exist anymore. There's no diagnosis for it. Wrong. There are a host of other areas. Language, speech and language, language development, ADHD, there are a host of other areas that we are still going to get Asperger's kids identified and eligible under special education. I'll share with you, in Pennsylvania, they double or duo find eligibility under duo criteria. They have a gifted, which also comes under special education, and then they have the other areas of eligibility. I have a granddaughter who is Asperger's, who is found eligible under social-emotional because of her lack of social skills, and gifted. So she has a duo eligibility. Very challenging to meet her needs because she is a black and white kid, off the chart intellectually. Social and emotional skills are way down. But they've got to balance that out. Her IEP addresses both. You don't have the duo in Michigan. But that doesn't mean you can't address both. Okay, progress. Progress is not based on grades. Just because a kid is doing okay, getting C's, passing, what more do you want? That's not the criteria for eligibility for special education. And that's where that comprehensive multidisciplinary evaluation comes in. What is the kid capable of? What has been their experience? Where did it fall apart? What can we expect from here forward? If you lower the bar and say everybody's just going to get C's, nobody would be eligible. So be really careful about the response, well, they're getting C's, they're passing all their classes, we don't need to go any further. That's not the criteria. The criteria is individual. It's based on a child's individual abilities. And that's where you assess across the board in all areas. If you disagree with the school's evaluation, if you disagree with the results of the evaluation, the way the evaluation is being interpreted, the application of their interpretation of the evaluations, you then can request an independent evaluation at the expense of the public school district. Okay, you have to go through the process, though. They have to evaluate themselves first. You have to disagree with it. Once they determine whatever their recommendations are, you can request an IEE, independent educational evaluation, at the school district expense, and that will then be considered by the school district. They don't have to adopt it. They don't have to adopt the recommendations of a independent evaluator, but they do have to consider it. Most school districts who want to do a thorough evaluation welcome that information. Okay? You do not have to have that independent evaluation done by the list that's provided by the school district. They'll give you a list of evaluators. I often recommend that an evaluator be in a different, that the independent evaluator that I would refer to is in a different geographical area of the state than the student is. There are really, really good evaluators out there, but they also have relationships with the school districts. So, for example, in Grand Rapids, I will recommend that they come to an evaluator, and there's some awesome ones in the Ann Arbor area. Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti, Detroit, I will recommend that they go to the ones that I recommend in Grand Rapids or Kalamazoo. It takes that relationship or question of neutrality out of the picture. Travel, yeah, you got travel for a day, but it really is worth the results you get. Okay, school districts, responsibility to identify. That protects the children not only who have academic issues and academic challenges, but also children who have behavioral challenges. There are two components to that. There's the component of the social-emotional evaluation, how do you support it, social work services, and so forth. The other component is what I call the functional behavioral analysis. Anybody ever heard of that? Okay. Functional behavioral analysis is separate from the IEP. It is an assessment, an evaluation that is done with the school district taking data. There's an ABC data sheet that the school district should be using. It is an antecedent, the behavior, and the consequence. The consequence is not what we think of as consequence. Consequence is not a punishment. It's not punitive. It's not what we're going to do to the kid because they are misbehaving. It is what is the kid getting out of it. The antecedent is the most difficult one for them to understand. Antecedent is what took place prior to the behavior that resulted in the behavior. That's both positive and negative. School districts, if they know what you're talking about on an FBA, to develop a PBIP, which is a positive behavior intervention plan, if they accept that fact, they still have problems with collecting the data. The antecedent is the most critical part. What took place before? What resulted in the behavior? Before doesn't mean 2 minutes before. Well, he came in from the playground and he was just totally out of control. It can be something that took place the night before. The kid didn't get any sleep all night. That's where that communication comes in. It can be last week. His grandmother passed away last week. So it's an antecedent that's resulting in undesirable behavior. But once you start doing that FBA and you start collecting that data for what is resulting in the undesirable behavior, you are also going to continue to collect data in what is resulting in the desirable behavior. Because if you can start maintaining and achieving desirable behavior, you want to know what's working so that when it falls apart, you know what went wrong or what went different. Okay? So a functional behavioral analysis is not just to determine what is negative behavior or what's undesirable behavior. It's also maintained to determine what do we have in place that's working and what do we need to do for this kid to make sure that we are continuing down the road of desirable behavior. Okay? Yes. Okay, 1 second.
Let me just come up.
I got to hold you up for Tim here.
Hang on.
How do you end up getting an FBA done? Is it outside? And it's outside of the IEP process, right?
It can be, say a child doesn't have an IEP.
It can be outside
the IEP process for students who don't have an IEP, may have a 504, or who may have nothing.
Do you just request it in writing the same way?
Yes.
Thank you.
And a functional behavioral analysis can be done for any student. They don't have to be eligible for special ed or for 504 accommodations.
Okay.
Can you say a little bit more about the consequence? You said it's what the kid got out of it. Can you say a little bit more?
Okay. Primary areas of consequence are escape, anxiety, try to get out of work, or sensory factors, which is huge in our ADHD population. So the consequence is what is the result for the student of the behavior? Are they getting out of work? Are they able to get out of an environment that they don't want to be in? It mind boggles me when the answer for a student who doesn't want to be in school is to suspend or expel. Like I said, I was one of those students. And if I didn't want to be in school, usually I would just take off. But when I had to be there or was being held accountable, I would find a way to get out of school. And in the 60s, that wasn't too hard to do. It was a pretty volatile environment. I went to Jackson Public Schools, which was a difficult environment in the 60s. So you didn't have to do a whole lot to just say, you're out of here. We're getting better about that, but the attitude still is, if a kid does something wrong, they're out of here. Well, man, especially when you get into middle school and high school, what do I have to do to get out of here? Because I don't want to be here at all. So I really try to work with the district for in-school consequences or somehow, I mean, you got to deal with risk of safety to the student or others. That's a reality, and they're responsible and they're liable. So if you've got a student who is really acting out, you do have to make accommodations for that. But I want to bend over backwards that accommodation or that whatever's put in place to address that is not removing the kid from the school, because that soon becomes a very convenient way for that kid to get out. Any other questions? Yes.
I'm going to hang on just a moment. I'll go right over here.
What about a child that's medically has difficulty and periodically, because medication is given in very strict parts, so they can't produce or can't learn for a period of time until the medication has done its job.
Okay.
And in terms of getting the school to be appropriate with the lack of ability
if there are periods of time that a student is not functioning, regardless of what that is, you're talking about a behavioral issue. There's all kinds of issues. I've got another granddaughter who is type 1 diabetes. When she is dealing with sugar levels that are out of whack, she's very much like our ADHD kids. She can't focus. She can't function. And so you need to accommodate for those periods. You hopefully will intervene so that they don't happen, because that loss of class time or that loss of content time can be detrimental. So you don't want to just say, oh, well, they're having a bad day or they're having a downtime, so we don't do anything. However, you can do things like if they had a clear period of time where they weren't focusing, and say they took a test and that test was not conducive of their usual
production.
Yeah. Then you would allow them to retake the test. Now I've got students.
You'd have to be able to get the school to agree.
That can be part of their IEP.
Right. Okay.
Absolutely.
But they have to realize they call it.
And that's the discussion that takes place at the table.
Okay.
That's where the parents educate, and you don't make excuses for kids, but you do have reality checks. I do have parents who make a lot of excuses for kids. I'm not going to go there. I want that kid to achieve at the highest, most productive level that they are capable of. I don't want to downplay that. I don't want to lower the bar. But I also want to have realistic expectations, whether that be high or low. I have parents who have way too high of expectations for their kids based on their abilities and based on their challenges. They're going to go to Harvard. Well, I got news for you. You know, community college looks really good right now if we can accomplish that. But on the other hand, I also don't want them to just say, oh, we don't have any expectations for this kid at all. So there's both ends of the spectrum, and usually what's best for the kid falls in the middle somewhere, but it's a learning process for everyone. And it's also a roller coaster that can deviate. The way a kid can work and accomplish in one class or one environment or with one type of teacher, which is critical, especially with our ADHD population, those personalities are huge. And one teacher in the exact same subject, exact same content, can make a huge difference on whether or not that kid is going to respond. So do I generally try to select teachers? Absolutely. And very rarely am I confronted with, they won't admit that they're allowing you to do it, because that will set a precedent, and we don't want to do that. but they will usually say, yeah, you know, that'd be a good fit. The discussion kind of goes down those lines, and that's okay, because that's going to make it easier on that teacher. Okay, the teacher who's going to battle a kid all year long is going to have the whole class being affected by it. I'll give you an example about a real little guy a couple months ago. Pretty severe behaviors, real significant sensory issues. His diagnosis and issues were ADHD symptoms, but way beyond that. He had a lot of challenges. And it was a little small school district, little tiny budget, which is always the first thing you hear. Didn't have a lot of staff. This little guy, when he needed to get out of the classroom or when he needed an escape, he needed it now. And if it didn't happen, that classroom was all going to go down. I have a couple of kids. Well, I have a very blended family. Raised four kids and then adopted four kids with special needs. So a couple of my younger kids had real severe sensory issues. And at home, I was a single mom. So there was just me. There wasn't a lot of staff around to take the kid out for a walk. So I put pup tents in my house. And when they had a problem or when they needed to regroup, whatever, they were allowed to go to those pup tents. I could still keep an eye on them. But they had fidgets and sensory stuff and all kinds of things in those little pup tents, and I probably had three or four of them throughout the house. So I kind of went back to that, and I said, well, let's put a pup tent in the classroom. Fortunately, I have a special ed director who I had worked with before. She was on board with whatever I said because it usually resulted in some positive things. That teacher looked at me like I had two heads. A pup tent in my classroom, right. And what do you think all the other kids are going to do? I said, I don't care what all the other kids are going to do. If you get this kid's sensory stuff under control and he has a place to go to regroup and come back to your classroom, it's going to make everybody's life easier. So the director says, I'll go out and buy one right now. I'll go right down to Walmart, $20 for a pup tent. I'll get it. Brought the pup tent back. We had another meeting 4 weeks later, and that teacher was like, just swallowed it. And she says, I cannot believe the difference in that child. He can go to that pup tent for 5 minutes, do his fidgets, because he needed isolation as well. You just couldn't hand him a fidget at his desk and expect that it was going to resolve. So he did, and she says, and by the way, I have 3 pup tents now. She says, I've got at least a dozen kids who have benefited from this. So simple solutions, you know, and again, that's just everybody talking, everybody being really creative, and everybody agreeing to do what's best for the kid. Okay, hopefully that addressed your question.
Who would cover the comprehensive multidisciplinary education evaluation? Would that be the school district that would cover the cost of that then?
Are you talking about the independent evaluation?
Yes.
Okay.
That you talked about.
Initially, we're going to let the school district do their comprehensive, mm-hmm. multidisciplinary, whatever they want to consider is multidisciplinary and comprehensive. Mm-hmm. If they want to do a predetermined evaluation with only one or two providers, I'm going to let them do it, and then I'm going to go out and get the independent evaluation. If that's what they're claiming is their evaluation, you have to let them do it first. But then the independent evaluation, you request after you have reviewed theirs, mm-hmm. and you request that you want an independent evaluation. Now, if you are requesting, that's all you have to do. You don't have to give a reason why. They'll tell you do, and they'll hand you a form that says you've got to outline exactly why, what areas, and so you don't. You just have to say, I disagree with your evaluation. Now, if you want to give them a little bit of insight, you can say, I disagree with it because it was incomplete, the evaluators were not qualified, your results are skewed, if you want to go there, but you don't have to go there. You also do not have to choose from their list of evaluators. You can choose anyone who is at least as qualified as their evaluators. That doesn't take a whole lot. So they'll tell you, most school districts are putting the cap at about 500 right now. You can't get an evaluation for $500, and you will disagree with that. And you will tell them that if they want to, you'll go to due process on that issue. They'll back right off.
Because I was quoted like $2,700.
That's pretty good.
Okay. So the school technically is going to sort of fight me on this, and I'm just going to have to forge ahead on it.
They have two choices, and two choices only. They can either grant you the authority to get an independent evaluation, or they can file for due process. There's nothing in between. They either have to grant you. Now, they'll try to put all those parameters on it, and that's where your battle will come in. But they either grant you the right to have that evaluation and authorize it, or they go to due process, and the purpose of them going to due process is to prove that their evaluation was sufficient. I've only had one school district in Michigan who attempted to do that. They will usually back right down off of that. Free and appropriate public education, FAPE. Okay? There's been a lot of discussion about this lately because 2 years ago, Michigan changed their approach to FAPE. The only time now, prior to that, parents signed off on every IEP. Your signing off was that you essentially agreed to the services that were offered in the IEP. There were three categories. You signed off that you agreed with the IEP and its implementation. Another category, you disagreed with the IEP, but you agreed to allow it to be implemented. That was where you agreed to see if it would work. Even though you had reservations about it, you had that option. Or you disagreed and you were going to go to mediation or due process. Now, the only time that you either agree or sign off is on the initial evaluation. And there's only one line. You either sign that you agree with it and its implementation, or you don't agree with it and you're going to go to due process. There's not the intermediate. I have school districts who will agree to that, but the form itself does not provide for it. Subsequent evaluations. You have your yearly annual review, and then you have your three-year evaluations that are required by law. In your annual subsequent review, the school district is allowed to develop an IEP. And there should be discussion, but many times there's not. Go to the table. They already have it drafted. They put draft on it, but it's already said and done. They hand it to you and say, take it or leave it. And that is allowed by the new requirement of no signature, no parental consent for subsequent implementation of an IEP. It's disastrous because your only option is to head to mediation or to due process. They can just say take it or leave it. Many school districts don't do that, but there are some who are really taking advantage of that. There are also some rule changes that are being proposed by the Department of Education that would minimize that even further, where they are attempting to take the parental involvement and the parental consent out of the rules. They're also limiting the educational evaluations even further. I mean, we don't even, in most districts, come close to a comprehensive multidisciplinary evaluation. And they are now proposing that only one or two individuals are required to do an evaluation. That is generally the school psychologist. And then if it involves EI or ASD, it would also involve the school social worker. But unless the school district agrees to bring in OT, PT, speech and language, those individuals are no longer required, or wouldn't, the rules have not been changed, okay, would no longer require that those other individuals be part of that IEP team. I have very few clients that would not require at least an assessment by those people, at least a look at. Maybe they don't need services. Maybe they only need a consult. Maybe they only need an assessment. But at least that individual should be part of that multidisciplinary team. And then if it's determined and everybody agrees that those services would not benefit that student, they can then not be involved any longer. But I want those people there initially. The new proposed rules would remove that requirement for those other providers. So essentially what they're saying is that the school psychologist does an academic, because that's usually what their focus is, and that will determine eligibility, and then on subsequent evaluations, what that child needs. So I encourage you to look for the public hearings, look for, we've got some legislators now who are on board. We've had a number of meetings. We've got the lieutenant governor who's on board. He also has a child with autism. This is stuff that was really trying to be slid through. And you need to stay on top of this stuff as parents, because if nobody responds, they can do it. And undoing rules and undoing laws is a whole lot more difficult than if you don't let it happen in the first place. Okay, the difference between the MET team and the IEP team. They are not one and the same. The MET team is the multidisciplinary education team that does the evaluation. They will do the evaluation. They will write a report, hopefully individual reports, but I've had them all combine their results, and then submit it to the IEP team. The MET team does not make a determination of eligibility. The IEP team does. So even though a student is found ineligible for special education, there is still an IEP team formed, even if it's just for that purpose. So if they come in and say, oh, we did these evaluations and he's not eligible, you need to take a look at who's at that table, because it needs to be the makeup of an IEP team, not just the people who evaluated, because it has to be the IEP team who makes a determination of eligibility. And eligibility is not a predetermined result. Oh, they didn't qualify for SL, for a specific learning disability in math calculation. No, because they've got severe emotional and behavioral issues. Or they didn't qualify for ASD, which is a huge issue right now. The medical diagnosis for autism spectrum and the educational criteria for autism spectrum are this far apart. I just did a huge full-day medical continuing legal education for DeVos Children's Hospital. They were so frustrated, the evaluations that they were doing to diagnose and then submitting these to school districts, 30-page diagnostic evaluations, and the school district was saying, we considered it, don't meet the criteria. In some cases, they don't meet the criteria because the criteria for ASD educational eligibility is so narrow. On the other hand, they don't meet the criteria because the school district only had to consider it and it didn't use educational language. It used medical language. So once these providers, I had doctors, I had family physicians, I had nurses, I had nurse practitioners, once they learned which language to use that was the same as what they were trying to communicate, they just substituted the educational language. We didn't have any problem at all, and the schools couldn't get out from under it. But they had no, you don't get that in medical school, and you don't even get it in education school, but the fact that they started using the right language, those reports that we're getting out of there now are phenomenal, and they're working, and kids are getting what they need. So language is huge, and education will tweak it and skew it and do everything they can if they want to get out from under something to interpret that adversely. So the IEP team either finds eligibility or doesn't find eligibility. There's nothing in between. And then your hard work starts. I generally don't care what area of eligibility they find a kid to qualify. if they're going to argue with me about SLD versus OHI versus something else, I'm not going to make that a big argument, because the door opens, and this is critical, okay? The door opens, and then the breadth of services become available. It doesn't matter what opens that door. Now, the school districts will try to narrow it down, but IDEA says once a child is found eligible, they are eligible for whatever they need. So open that door with eligibility. It's not going to be a big argument. My, which a lot of people stay away from, my prime one is OHI, other health impaired, which a lot of ADHD students fall under, because that doesn't have a defined, narrow view associated with it. It's whatever the other health impaired requires. So I'm actually thrilled to get other health impaired, because that doesn't allow them to narrow down what they're going to provide for a student. But your ADHD kids can fall under any of the criteria, whether it's specific learning disabilities, some of them even emotionally impaired. That's usually if things have really gone poorly for a long period of time and they've reached that point. But a lot of times you need to address it within that realm in order to get back on track. Okay, so it's whatever the kid needs.
Can you tell me how a 504 or an IEP follows a student through school, like from elementary to high school, and does it go to college, or is it part of the record, or how does that work?
IEP can incorporate Section 504, okay, because an IEP is related services and or modifications and accommodations. Okay, so the IEP is your biggest umbrella. Section 504 cannot incorporate IEP provisions. It is only accommodations. You might get some modification in there, but it's primarily for accommodations. That's just how it's worded. Okay, so the ultimate thing that I always go for is an IEP. Then if they legitimately don't qualify for an IEP, we will negotiate a Section 504 plan. I've gotten really good at making Section 504's IEPs. If necessary. All right, now that an IEP or a Section 504 will follow a student through 12th grade or graduation. Anything beyond that, you have to resort then to the Section 504. IDEA doesn't go beyond 12th grade. Section 504, though, where those, and you have to set a history, you have to establish a history within your public school, because you can't, well, I don't want to say can't, because I have done it, but it's much more difficult to wait till a kid's a freshman in college and then go in and make that initial request for a 504 or accommodations. So it's much better, as well as the fact that you have to establish it for the SATs, the ACTs, for any of those test accommodations, too. If it's not established and that's your first request, you're not going to get it. You're going to get denied. So does that explain? Okay.
Going back to the signature, mm-hmm. and if you've signed it, is that true for a change in placement, too, that you don't have any rights?
Well, you've got rights.
No, I mean in terms of you've already signed, but if there's a change in placement.
A placement is the result of an IEP. So you develop, then a lot of times they want to do that backwards too, but you develop the IEP, and then based on the IEP and the needs of the child, you determine placement. So essentially, subsequent placement, initial placement would fall under the initial IEP, mm-hmm. and you would have to approve. Mm-hmm. But change in placement, you would still have to approve of a change in placement.
Okay.
Okay, because stay put is still in the law. They want to try to do away with it. Mm-hmm. And it's very rare that you see anyone implementing it in Michigan. For some reason, I don't know why. But stay put is still in place. So if you disagree with a change in placement, but you would have to file for due process, mm-hmm. then you could maintain stay put and have them stay put until that process evolves.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
back to the 504 following on through college, and you were saying it has to be established ahead of time.
It should be. I've gotten initial 504 plans for students at the college level,
right.
But it's a lot more difficult.
The 504 that my son has some accommodations in it, but he hasn't yet used them because he hasn't needed to yet. We're still trying to determine what the best accommodations for him are. Mm-hmm. I was told that it's possible he will not be able to use those accommodations on a standardized test like SAT if he's never used them before.
That is possible.
How will they know? I mean, if he says, I need an hour and I need an extra time on my SAT, what do they do? Do they go back and pull all his teachers and say, hey, has he ever used extra time
probably
on tests before?
Probably not. But
do they require a paper signed or something?
I mean, they probably aren't going, if it's in his plan,
yeah.
And that plan has been in place,
mm-hmm.
And the school is submitting that plan with their request for those accommodations, they're probably not going to investigate it.
Okay.
But the legitimate answer is, if he hasn't used them or they haven't been established, he won't get them for the test.
Okay.
So if they do find out,
they could deny his that possibility.
Probably.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Another couple of questions here.
Hi. Could you talk about the parameters that a school district can and cannot put on an IEE?
Most of the ones that they try to. It's reasonable, the whole terminology, and it's more established by court cases than by the IDEA is really vague on IEEs and what can and cannot be done. It's usually been established by court cases, but it's reasonable. Whatever is a reasonable evaluation to determine the needs of the child. And some of those can be really elaborate. Now, the thing to remember is that anything that is diagnostic or for treatment purposes can be billed to your insurance. And the school districts can require you to do that in the first instance. Okay, so if it's clinical treatment or diagnosis, some of it can be covered by your insurance. That'll be their first step. And then whatever's left over, then they have to pick up. So a lot of what you're asking and what you're asking your evaluator to do is how it's worded about whether or not, I mean, in all fairness to the school district, if you can get your insurance company to pay for part of it, do so. Don't make that a battle. Those who do independent evaluations on a regular basis know how to word that request to get some of that done. Now, I do know that some of those evaluators are now requiring the school districts to pay up front because they've been burned. So that is becoming a problem. School districts don't want to pay for an evaluation they haven't seen or had access to. They don't want to do it up front, and the evaluator is saying, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to evaluate unless you do. So we've gone full circle a couple of times on some instances. I don't know what the answer to that is, but it is what it is. Because it's sad, but they got the evaluation. School district says, yep, we considered it, and we're not paying for it. So you'd have to go to due process in order to battle that. And, I mean, again, I come from the coast. Due process, as an administrative law judge, my due process results came out 50-50. 50-50 for parents, 50-50 for school district. That's generally the way it would come out. Nobody's perfect on either side. In Michigan, in the primary Midwest states, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, your parents have less than a 10% chance of prevailing. I have never taken a case since I've come back here to due process. I have referred some because the parents were adamant about doing it, but for me, that type of result and the emotional and the financial drain that that's going to take on a family and the animosity that it is going to result in for that child who has to remain in that school district for the most part, it's not worth it. So if it comes down to going to do, I'll file a state complaint State complaint is just where they essentially slap their hands for doing something wrong and say you got to make it better, and you ask for a resolution. It's usually teacher training. It's a broad type of resolution, and that's okay because that has a positive result. It's not that difficult to do. But due process is extremely draining, and I will avoid it and tell my parents to avoid it at all costs if there's any way we can negotiate resolution at the table. And not everybody is always going to get what they want. I mean, it is a negotiation. You're not going to get the Cadillac. The IDEA doesn't require that you have the Cadillac. You're going to get the Ford or Chevy, and that's okay, as long as your child's making sufficient progress. And that sufficient progress is not just today. Okay, there's this, the 2004 IDEA changes added that not only is it sufficient progress within their schooling in the immediate, it also needs to prepare them for post-secondary goals. Okay, this is something the school districts are losing sight of, because right now, with the new mandates, especially for a diploma, they are trying to push these kids through. And they will give credits, and many of these students are not prepared. They'll circumvent the mandate somehow, somewhere, and they will get these kids through, and then they will go to whatever their post-secondary goals are, and they are not prepared. So be careful of that with your high school students. Be careful of them loading that curriculum with, simple life skills programs and so forth, and then graduating your student. They have till they're 26. I don't care whether it's diploma or certificate. Diploma doesn't have to be in 4 years. If it takes them 6 years, so be it. My own son took 6 years. He got a diploma, though. They said he never would. They had him on certificate. I said, not going to do that. He had it. I may as well go there now. He had a personal curriculum in every class. Anybody heard of a personal curriculum? Okay. Personal curriculum is something that for a student with an IEP only, not Section 504, with an IEP only, allows the district to modify the content of the core curriculum. They still have to get the core, but it has to be whatever they're capable of achieving based on their disability. And you can modify that fairly significantly. Right now, in Michigan, you have to have 2 years of a foreign language, you have to have 4 years of English, 4 years of advanced math, which is the huge issue. You can modify that. You can get rid of that fourth year of math. You can actually modify for a child who is either English impaired somehow or has significant disabilities in the language area. You can modify those 4 years of English. It takes a personal curriculum, and I've had to walk most school districts through that because the Department of Education has given very little guidance on how to do it and who's eligible and what it should consist of. But I've got school districts who are begging for it, because I had one little country school district that was losing 50% of their seniors under the new mandates. Now, the only ones they could help with a personal curriculum were those with an IEP. And suddenly, we had a lot of kids with IEPs in their senior year. But these folks wanted to help these kids. They wanted to graduate these kids. And it was a fluke about not being able to get through algebra trig or not being able to get through a high-level English. It had nothing to do with their normal average academic ability. The other thing that the new mandates are causing havoc with is vocational education. We've got kids who are fully capable of having successful careers in vocational areas. The new high school mandates are filling their schedules so intensely, and then you split the algebra into 2 years because they've got a math disability. Or anyway, their schedules are being so influxed with meeting those mandates, there's no room for vocational education. So if they don't make the grade on those mandatory requirements that assume everybody's going to be a doctor or an engineer, they also are not going to get vocational training. So they're either going to drop out with no training, or they're going to finish high school with no training. And there's not very many places for them to go, except the street. So the mandates, I understand where they came from. I understand those for the high-level kids and those who can be successful, but not exclusively. I'll tell you right now, I probably would not have graduated from high school without an IEP because I have severe math phobia, they call it. I had an instructor that said, you don't have a math disability, you've got math phobia. And maybe that's correct. Maybe that is more accurate. Regardless, I can't do math. And I certainly can't do high-level math. I started out in vet school, and that diminished that. But it didn't mean that I couldn't complete a successful profession. I just had to change gears. Now I'm a rotten attorney. Mm-hmm. No. Well, actually, in Michigan, I need to clarify that. In Michigan, I am not an attorney. Okay, I'm a member of the Massachusetts Bar, not the Michigan Bar. So in Michigan, and I tell all my clients, don't say you're bringing your attorney. I am not an attorney. Because the good old boys in this state will come after me for the unauthorized practice of law. So in Michigan, I'm an advocate with a heck of a legal background.
Okay. We have another question here.
Yeah.
I'm a lawyer. I went to law school because I can't do math.
So. Yeah, okay, there we go.
And one suggestion from my experience with my son is bring food to an IEP.
Oh, yes.
They love it, and mm-hmm. now I have this reputation. I have to bring it every year. But one question I had is my son's now in fifth grade, and increasingly it's the accommodation piece that, you know, I seem to have neglected at the IEPs, and I'm always negotiating them with the current classroom teacher. So do you have any suggestions for building those classroom accommodations into the IEP?
What's the eligibility?
Ojai.
Ojai,
ADHD. He's very complex, but primarily ADHD. He has a number of neurological issues.
Okay. The CHAD website actually has a great list of accommodations. Rights Law has a great list of accommodations. They have a checklist, and I would just run off those checklists and check off what you feel would be helpful. And the negotiation is, let's try it. You're not going to hold them to it. You might even incorporate some of it. If they're really resisting, incorporate it into a behavior plan first. Because the behavior plan is fluid. You don't have to come back. They're reluctant to put some of these things as accommodations in an IEP because in order to change it, you've got to come back with an entire IEP team. So a lot of times, if it's appropriate, I will put those types of things into a behavior plan because that can be tweaked as you go along. That's exactly the purpose of it, is to try and does it work, doesn't it work? Is it what is based on our data? And that is fluid so that they can even send you an email, hey, we're going to try this week. Okay. Then you don't have to bring the whole IEP team back. But it sounds to me like there should be a functional behavior analysis and a behavior plan for that student.
I'm gonna double check because I always forget what we've done, but I'm going to look at that. Thank you.
Yep.
And we had another one up here, I think. Did you still have a question? Okay.
My son is in the eighth grade and has autism. And in another workshop that we went to, it was suggested that we take the READ. The reevaluation of existing data, right? Is that, yeah. But we all agree it wouldn't change his classification or his services. So do you...
So you still do the READ.
Do we? Okay.
Yeah, the READ, and you just determine that no further evaluation is done.
Okay.
The READ is the review. So you review all your existing data, and then you determine that that is accurate as a team, If you're in agreement with that, then you just determine that no, and on the READ form, they will have that checkpoint. No further evaluation is necessary. All parties agree that it shall continue.
Okay, but they were also talking about doing IQ testing, and
is then that becomes a discussion of whether or not the team agrees that it's necessary.
Okay.
Now, IQ is different than achievement. They might want an achievement test to determine progress. Okay, a psych ed is usually done to create a base, a foundation, and then an achievement test is generally done at least every 3 years in order to determine progress. That may be what they're referring to.
Okay.
Okay. All right, I am way off base here, but that's my ADHD. So if I'm addressing your questions, we're okay. Okay, good. General education teachers versus special ed. With the whole movement toward inclusion, I got a feel for these gen ed teachers, okay? Usually a special ed teacher will have a classroom that consists of mostly kids with similar issues and similar challenges. Then they are certified on top of it to deal with those students. Okay, with the inclusionary movement toward gen ed, which by the way I agree with, I absolutely agree that kids do better if that's the appropriate environment for them. However, those teachers have not been trained. And I hear from it all the time. If I'd wanted to be a special ed teacher, I would have gone into it. And, you know, especially for the ones who started teaching 15, 20 years ago, this movement was not in place. They had no idea. And then it's compounded by the fact that they are getting a dozen, 15 students with all different challenges and different IEPs with no training whatsoever on how to implement. I mean, it's clearly a knee-jerk, try this and put out this fire while you're putting out this fire over here, and then your gen ed kids are in there in the middle somewhere. So it does raise havoc, and there is a legitimate concern for the whole idea with inclusion was to include students with supports. The with supports is what's missing. I mean, good luck trying to get your kid a one-on-one aid, which in order to be included may be what they need. But they drop them in, okay, we're including. They're going to go in there, they're going to sit in the back of the room and do diddly squat, but they're included because the teacher can't do any more. And there's not the parapro staff or the social work staff or the OT staff in order to accommodate what those kids need in that classroom. So be careful of the whole inclusionary thing. Your student may need a resource room. That doesn't mean they're not being included. It means they need specialized teaching and technique in order to benefit from their educational environment. So be careful about this, especially around Ann Arbor. That inclusionary movement is becoming unrealistic because it's losing sight of what the student needs as opposed to this philosophical push. Okay, so that's a huge caution. Alternative school placements. We've got charter schools now, we've got homeschool, we've got homebound, which is very different. Okay, homebound is a child who cannot attend school, usually for medical reasons, but it can also be for behavioral reasons. That's different than homeschooled. In Michigan, you can declare that you're going to homeschool any student as long as you can provide a legitimate curriculum that you're going to be following and that the school monitors it. In either case, charter school, homeschool, homebound, if a child has an IEP, they are still eligible for services. For related services. Homebound, it is so minimal. It is 2 hours of tutoring per week as far as the academic component. Now, they are still eligible for social work, OT, PT, speech and language, if in fact that's in their IEP. So that would be over and above the tutoring. Don't let them tell you that that's all, if the OT comes, that substitutes for the tutoring. It does not. It's over and above those services. Homeschooled students are still eligible for related services. Children in private schools can still be eligible for related services. That's why you maintain an IEP. It's not the implementation of the IEP, it's the related services. Child Find extends to non-public schools also. So they are required to seek out students in private schools for eligibility. Excuse me, I'm almost going to make it to 8:30 here. Individual with Disabilities Act has not been looked at, excuse me, since 2004. There's been a lot of talk about it. There's all kinds of issues right now that they're going to be looking at, and they keep saying it's going to happen. 2014 was the last year I heard. My guess is it's probably not going to happen until at least 2016. Some of the issues that are going to come out of it are an emphasis from the legal process to a focus on outcomes and accountability. That's the whole movement that you're seeing in Michigan right now. Students with disabilities, in 2004, it was felt that the parents and the students lost a lot of clout with what they were entitled to do, and I think that's why you're seeing your due process decisions, because again, you know, an administrative law judge can only go on the interpretation of the law and the evidence that's presented. They can't make it up out of their good heart, which sometimes I wanted to do. But that's what you've got to go on. So if your decisions are coming out based on the absolute letter of the law, that's what you're stuck with. And I think that 2004 changes removed a lot of parental input. And again, Michigan's saying they're trying to catch up. The DOE is saying they're trying to catch up with the federal changes by removing some of these parental provisions in there. I question that. Some of the other areas that are going to be brought up are going to be teacher qualifications and effectiveness. So it's not only just qualified and certified, it's effectiveness. And that accountability is going to come out in the new IDEA, I guarantee it. Seclusion and restraint is another area that's going to come out. It's a huge topic. Michigan only has guidelines. And if you've got a school district or a program that wants to utilize restraints and seclusion, they will tell you that it's only guidelines and they can do anything they want. It is supposed to be only used if there is a threat of serious harm, risk of harm to the student or others. I can tell you that there are programs in this state that use it multiple times within a day on children for long periods of time in kindergarten all the way up. There's supposed to be time limits based on age. I know of kindergartners and first grades that are in it probably 90% of the school day. So it's going to be a huge issue. You can also address it within your IEPs and within your behavior plans. You can put limitations and parameters on that in your approach. Your behavior plan is supposed to be a positive behavior plan, positive behavior intervention plan, focused on before the fact, not after the fact, knee-jerk reaction, take them down in four prone. And that is happening in this state. When I lived in Kalamazoo, there was a school district parchment over in that area. It was about 10 years ago, and a young lady was taken down in four prone. She didn't breathe. And that school district had some major revamp. But there are still school districts doing it. They're just more careful. The CIP, which is what most school districts are trained in, the focus of CIP is intervention. The training is intervention. The problem is the people whose philosophy or mentality is not intervention, they resort to the last step. And the last step is usually severe restraint or seclusion. There's all kinds of steps that are supposed to take place before him. I'm trained in CIP. A critical intervention program or plan. Okay, I'm done. Any other questions? If you have individual situations or questions and would like, I can stay after for a few minutes to try to address some of those too.